Many courtrooms are having bond and arraignment hearings through a TV monitor instead of in person. This can be more efficient, but is it fair to defendants? Here's law professor Locke Bowman.
Any of us would want to be physically present with the person making the decision, as opposed to just being an image on a video screen.
Plus, if you've ever been convicted of a felony, finding a job can be a big challenge. Now there's a law that might help. Also this hour, during World War II, the U.S. forced millions of Japanese Americans into internment camps. Here's how the federal government explained this in 1943.
No one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move.
More than 10,000 people were moved to Illinois during that time, many to Peoria. Later this hour, how that city actually became a haven for Japanese Americans. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, the history of how many Japanese Americans ended up in central Illinois, specifically Peoria, after they were forcibly relocated from their homes during World War II. But for much of today's hour, we're going to be looking at our criminal justice system. Later, how one new law may help people get jobs after they've been released from prison, and right now, video courts. An arraignment hearing is usually when you have a chance to plead guilty or not guilty. It's also when the court decides to formally charge you with a crime. Today, many courthouses substitute those in-person hearings, as well as bond hearings, with a video court. Although video court can be efficient, saving time and money, some people also say it's more safe. It has concerns for others. A few years after a lawsuit challenged the process in Cook County, the practice was discontinued. This was back in 2009. It was also discontinued around the same time in Winnebago County, but in many other places in Illinois, in Champaign, Peoria, Kankakee counties, just to name a few, still use video courts. That's based on reporting by the Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines, who's back with us in studio, along with one of the people she spoke with for her story, Charles Davidson. Charles, Lee, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Glad to be here.
Charles, you first encountered video court back in 2000. You were charged with obstruction of justice. Can you tell us what this experience was like, being put in front of a camera and a TV instead of appearing in front of a judge in a courtroom?
Well, I really didn't know I was going in front of a camera. You know, I didn't know anything about the video court. So I didn't know about it to begin with. Right. I thought we was finna go get sackled up like we used to, you know, since I've been over there a few times. But when I got in there, you know, I'm looking at how everything was going, you know, the judge sitting in the, like, you know, we look like looking at the TV, you know, the video, and he's calling people out one by one. So.
And it happens, does it happen fast, I imagine? It's a pretty fast process.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And do you think in the case of this instance of which you were charged with obstruction of justice, do you think it would have made a difference if you had been able to speak to a judge in person about your situation?
I think it would have because, you know, I've been over there several times and what I was charged with, I did, but this case here, I didn't, you know, I was not guilty of. So
you were charged. I wonder if you could share a little bit. You were charged. It was obstruction of justice. The police, was this a case of, you said the police had the wrong person?
Right. So one day, my mother called me and told me to come over to the house, call the police because there were some kids in the neighborhood shooting, you know, I think it was 3rd of July. And they were shooting bottle rockets up at the house, and she thought the house might catch a fire. So I went over there and called the police. They came out, and I was explaining to them that this was Edwards' home, and the kids were Edwards here, but there's other kids in the neighborhood coming down here firing off bottle rockets, and that my mother had asked me to call the police.
And so the police thought that your last name was Edwards.
Yeah, so after they, you know, did a little research around the neighborhood and, you know, going down the street, seeing if they can find other kids, they came back. Then they asked me my name. I said, my name is Charles. And then they left, and I left. When I came back, they go in the house. They ran from around the back of my house, and grabbed me and told me that I had lied to him and that I had a warrant on me.
They had a warrant for an arrest for someone named Edwards.
Named Charles Edwards, yeah. Then he showed me the picture of the guy. It was, you know, it was a dark-skinned guy. It wasn't me, you know.
So you got charged with obstruction of justice because the police think you lied about your last name being Edwards instead of Davidson?
Right.
And that's how you end up in front of the police for this video court hearing?
Right, that's it.
And what was the result of that? What ended up happening?
Well, I had a public defender. I couldn't afford a real lawyer, so he suggested to me that they would convict me on it because of my background. So I was offered 18 months, so the county jail is kind of rough, so I took the 18 months and, you know, went ahead to the Department of Correction.
Mm. We're talking with Charles Davidson about his experience with video court. This was almost 20 years ago that he's sharing his experience with us. We know about him because of reporting that Lee Gaines did. She's in studio with us. I want to bring someone else, Rosalie Joy, into this conversation. She's the Vice President and Defender of Legal Services at National Legal Aid and the Defender Association. Hi, Rosalie. Thanks for being with us as well.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Rosalie, as you're listening to Charles' story, I wonder how often we are hearing about video court. How much of this is we're seeing this being used nationally when we're talking about arraignment and bond hearings in particular?
Sure. I can tell you that I think that video conferencing is on the rise as governments and public safety agencies look for ways to save money and time. We do see a rise in the use of video conferencing. And from the lens of both people that are accused as well as the attorneys who are representing them, we have serious concerns. It does present significant barriers and challenges to the process and to the ability of the attorney to really effectively represent the people that they're trying to help.
Lee, for your reporting, you were able to talk to a couple of people about this. First of all, Rosalie's saying it seems to be on the rise nationally. Do we know what it looks like in Illinois?
We don't have any exact numbers. Actually, I would say the research, and I think Rosalie would agree with this, the research on video court is fairly limited, and there's no study that goes through all 50-something counties in Illinois. But I can tell you just from the calls that I've made, and you mentioned this in your introduction, Kankakee, Champaign County, Peoria County, and Fulton County, which was actually where I went to see video court in action and in person. I visited a sheriff there who told me his perspective on video court. And that's a rural county in west central Illinois. He said really what was driving them to do that was money, was cost savings.
And you actually spoke with Sheriff Jeff Standard of Fulton County. Here's what he said to you, to Lee.
Anytime I do not have an incarcerated individual in the courthouse where I have to have security on hand, that's a benefit to me. Anytime I don't have to have anybody over there being watched is a benefit to me.
County Sheriff Jeff Standard. Rosalie, if we hear sheriffs, judges that Lee also talked to said this was saving taxpayer money, I wonder what your reaction is to that, Rosalie.
My reaction to that is that while public safety agencies may consider it a safety and personnel savings, there are greater concerns than that. And really, on the back end of that process, an increased likelihood that there are more costs involved. Studies do show that the use of video conferencing increases bail amounts. It also increases the number of people that are put in jail and the number of nights that they have to stay there. Studies show that the cost of housing people across the United States per night, per person, can range anywhere from $48 a night to upwards of $500 a night. And because the studies do show that video conferencing is increasing those jail stays, there really isn't as great a cost savings as one might think at first glance.
We're speaking with Rosalie Joy. I should mention also, we did reach out to the judge that Lee spoke to in her story, Judge Ford, to join us today. He's actually in court right now, so he couldn't join us, but he did say via email, he released a statement. He just said, we can't put this in the context of defendants maybe not feeling good about being on video, there are constitutional rights to be considered which have to be followed. In a time of decreasing budgets, money can be saved, but not at the expense of violating anyone's rights. That's what Judge Ford said when we asked him to join us today. When we're talking about rights, I mentioned at the beginning of this a lawsuit that was brought against Cook County's chief judge in 2006 that challenged the use of video court. It was filed by Locke Bowman, who's joining us now. He's a professor of law at Northwestern University, also director of the MacArthur Justice Center. Hi, Locke. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here this morning.
Locke, as we're hearing about the constitutional rights of this, I wonder, from the lawsuit that you filed quite some time ago, as we've been hearing Rosalie talk about rights, we've been listening to Charles's story, what are some of the specific constitutional issues you had with, I'm going to use Cook County because that was the lawsuit that you originally filed?
What we said in Cook County is that using video as a substitute for an in-person bond hearing violates due process. People who come before a court asking for their liberty before they're convicted of any crime have a right to a fair procedure and a meaningful hearing. The way the courts have looked at this is they've said, well, what's the cost and what's the benefit of having a procedural protection? We say having the defendant get an opportunity to stand up in front of the judge himself or herself with a lawyer standing by his side and plead his case for pretrial release, that's a very important component of fairness. That's part of having a fair hearing. And so you ask the question, well, what is the cost of that hearing in terms of the inconvenience and the loss of expediency to the state on the one hand, and you measure that against the importance of the rights at stake on the other hand. One of the things that folks around the country have been talking about is how critical a moment the pretrial release hearing is for an individual facing criminal charges. If you are locked up before you go to trial, your chances of getting convicted are exponentially greater. If you are locked up before trial, you are, you know, in jeopardy of facing the situation that Mr. Charles Davidson talked about just a few minutes ago, where even though you're innocent, the pressure on you, the hardship of being locked up in a county jail is so overwhelming that you may just decide to give up your right to trial and plead guilty, even though you're innocent, just to get yourself out of the jail. And we see that happens round and round the country. If you are locked up before trial, your chance to work is at an end. You may have a relative, children who are in need of your presence in their lives. That comes to an end. Your connections to the community come to an end. Rosalie talked about the costs of incarceration, but there are also costs that ripple out and magnify across the entire community every time a person is locked up, an innocent person who hasn't been convicted of anything. So you weigh those important issues against expediency. And our argument was the importance of having the person present for the sake of fairness is overwhelmingly clear. And I think that's why Chief Judge Tim Evans in Cook County, when he examined the claims in our lawsuits, decided on his own that he was going to end video bond court up here in Cook County.
And so that's a video bond court. Rosalie, just to clarify, we're really seeing video court proceedings. Is it for arraignment and for bond hearings?
Well, there can actually be more activities going on in a first appearance. What we're seeing in video conferencing is an attempt to be as efficient through the eyes and lens of the court and the judges to do as much as they can to process the case at first appearance. So in addition to bond reviews and negotiated pleas, we're also seeing the use of these video conferencing systems for probable cause hearings. And I'll tell you, through the lens of an attorney, a public defender, a criminal defense lawyer, we as attorneys cannot at all guarantee that we are able to comply with our ethical duty to maintain confidentiality with our clients.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Rosalie, to that point, Charles, we were talking about this before we went on air. Charles, you were talking about how everything is all happening in one room in front of you when you're going for a video conferencing.
Right.
Lee, as we are thinking about this, we just have about a minute left for this conversation. Unfortunately, I just wanted to ask you, we've heard all of the sides of this. I just wanted to ask you, regardless of how you come down on the issue, for Illinois right now, does it seem like these practices of video conferencing via court, it seems like for parts of Illinois, this is something that isn't going away anytime soon?
That's correct. From the sheriffs that I've talked to and the counties that I know are doing it, they're pretty satisfied with it. They like it. And it's, you know, the judge here in Champaign County that I talked to, Judge Ford, is really happy with it. He'd actually like to expand the use of video court to cover more proceedings. So I do want to point out, though, that there are places in Illinois and places around the country that have voluntarily decided to end the use of video conferencing as well. So as much as it may be here to stay, it also is something that can be ended if there's a will to do so.
That's Lee Gaines. If you're interested in this issue, we are going to send out Lee's reporting. If you follow us on Twitter, we'll post it on Facebook or at our website as well. I want to thank Lee Gaines for being with us, Rosalie Joy with the Defender Legal Services, Locke Bowman with the MacArthur Justice Center, and Charles Davidson for sharing your story with us. All of you, thank you for your time. Charles, thank you especially for sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about our criminal justice system. We just heard Locke Bowman discussing the costs of incarceration. When it comes to lowering recidivism, we often hear about the role that employment plays in keeping people from returning to prison. Well, the state of Illinois has opened up a few more opportunities for residents with criminal records, opportunities that have long been closed off. Licensing laws for more than 100 jobs have now been made more accessible to people with criminal backgrounds, and lawmakers have also expanded the types of convictions that can be sealed from employers. How many people are we talking about here? If you consider that more than 27,000 people left Illinois prisons last year, this could mean a difference for a lot of people able to look for and get a job. Joining me to talk about this are Sadiqa Williams, the Vice President of Policy and External Affairs with the SAFER Group. That's an organization that works to support people with arrest and conviction records. She's on the line with us from Chicago. Johnny Taylor is with us from Virginia, where he's President and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management. But first, we wanted to start with Cassandra Hunt, a Champaign resident who previously was incarcerated and now works at the University of Illinois. She serves as a peer mentor with the First Followers Reentry Program. All of you, welcome to the 21st. First, Cassandra, especially, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're so very welcome. I appreciate you asking.
Cassandra, if I could just start with you. You spent some time in jail in Champaign County and then in the Logan Correctional Center. That was more than 15 years ago. I wonder if you could just briefly let us know how you ended up there.
I ended up there by making bad choices. I caught a few what they would call retail thefts, and they were enhanced in Champaign County to theft with a prior, and then it was enhanced to retail burglary.
Mm. And what was it
and
like?
That's how I ended up.
Yeah. And then, so this was more than 15 years ago when you first got out and you tried to find a job. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
What was that like?
It was very hard. Trying to find a job with a criminal history or being an ex-incarcerated person, it's very hard because a lot of employees are afraid, for one, and then also a lot of employees are don't know who they're hiring, so they get to a point where that they don't want to hire people that have a background.
I wonder if you can give us an example of jobs that you tried to get that you couldn't because of your criminal history.
Well, in Champaign County, we actually have a big factory that's called Craft, which is one. I applied there. I couldn't get there because of my criminal history, because they do a thorough background check on you. Another place was I actually were trying to get hired at to do home care. My mother ended up getting sick, so I got in the home care field. I wanted to take care of my mother myself, and then I ended up getting offered a job to do it, but you had to be certified. You had to be a certified person to get it. So I couldn't do neither one of them because of my criminal background at the time.
And how long have you been at your current job?
I've been in my current job, it'll be 3 years on February the 18th.
And how tough was it for you to get to that position?
It was, extremely tough, but it took a lot of determination because with you having a criminal history, you have to get approved by a committee. And you don't get a chance to go to that committee yourself. There's a liaison lady that goes in there for you to present you to the committee to make a decision if they're going to allow you to work for the University of Illinois. I had to go get a lot of reference letters. I had to get letters from my ex-employers. I had to also, what was most important, I had to have had a job for at least 2 years straight.
Cassandis, I mentioned that you are, in addition, we've been talking about your job, but you also are a peer mentor with the First Followers Reentry Program. As I was just laying out some of the new changes to Illinois laws now, how important do you think that is for people who are returning from incarceration to trying to find work or to get education so they can be licensed in different professions?
I think it's extremely important in order to help our society be stronger and help people be successful and succeed in the society, in our society today. I think that peer mentors and having programs such as the First Followers are very important because you need someone that has either been through it or can help you go through it and can walk you through it to be able to give you the encouragement to let you know, because all these things take a process, so nothing happens immediately. And when you're coming out of incarceration, you have a mind frame of, if it don't happen, then that means no, or they're not going to do it. So it takes determination, and the mentor program that I'm a part of, it helps people know that it may not happen immediately, but you have to keep pushing in order to get doors open.
And I wonder now also, so not only do you have to keep pushing, how important is it that those doors open, that people are able to actually find jobs?
It's very important because it keeps people from repeating the offense or offenses in order to take care of their families. A lot of financial situations drive people back to doing things that they either have did in the past or things that they normally wouldn't do. But I think with a decent paying job, making money where that you can take care of your family, it helps you be more productive, not just to society, but to your own family, and it gives you a higher self-esteem within yourself to know that you're able to go to work every day and you're able to pay your bills and you're not trying to scrape and scrap and wondering about the lights getting cut off or the water getting cut off or your kid not having the right clothes to go to school and not being able to buy school supplies. It helps you have that self-esteem that makes you want to not get in trouble.
I appreciate that. I know you have to get back to work. I know you've been on break to talk to us, but I appreciate you sharing your story with us, Cassandis. Thank you so much. And we'll tweet out some more information about First Followers as well.
Yes, first followers is very important, and it helps a lot of people coming home. And I think that that's what we need in order to be able to help people to transition back into society and be successful. So thank you so very much for allowing me to share my story and allowing me to be able to hopefully someone may hear and be able to help them to know that it is possible for you to be able to get back in society and work, and hopefully your employees won't be fearful of people that's been ex-incarcerated.
Thanks, Cassandis. I appreciate you sharing your story as well.
Okay. Have a nice and a blessed day. I appreciate you
too.
All. And I'll be listening.
We have been talking about this issue of we've been hearing Cassandis' story. We've been talking about some laws that have changed in Illinois regarding this issue. Sadiqa Williams is with us, the vice president of policy and external affairs with the Safer Group. She's on the line from Chicago, as well as Johnny Taylor with the Society for Human Resource Management. Johnny, can I just ask you, as we heard Cassandis tell her story about just being employed, I think some people are knowing when they talk about this issue, they think about the ban the box issue and the fact that in Illinois, employers are actually banned from looking into an applicant's criminal background, at least in the early stages of the interview process. Is that's sort of the initial step? Do you feel like that was one important tool when we're thinking about this conversation?
Yeah, we at the Society for Human Resource Management, you know, we have 300,000 members across the globe, and we represent some 115 million employees who are working every day. And it became very clear to us that people's personal bias and biases would come through either HR managers or line managers, the first line managers, the individuals who are deciding if they would hire someone, that their own biases, their own fears, would come through, and therefore people who otherwise were really qualified to do the work were not being given the opportunity. They were prevented from going and advancing through the hiring process simply because we saw, an indication, there was some indication that they had been arrested and or had been incarcerated. So banning the box, at least at the early stages of the process, was really important. It was an important advancement in terms of opening the opportunity for people who had been formerly employed. There was an admitted bias.
And Sadiqa, so Johnny's talking about that one aspect of it, but then there's the whole idea of bias and getting employers to hire these people, but there's also the goal of these laws. Historically, were there specific jobs that people coming out of prison were not able to consider because of some of these licensing changes?
Absolutely. And I think it's really, first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in the show. But I think we have to go back to just perception, right? And what was perceived and what has been actual. And so for decades, people with convictions had the perception, and it actually was occurring, where they could not get licenses in key occupations. And it might have been that they went through the education, they put in an application, and on the application itself, before they could even apply to a state agency, it had that question regarding do they have a conviction, and, they marked it, and for whatever reason, they were either told to not apply and move forward, or they saw the question and they say, okay, well, I shouldn't even move forward. And so, the living wage occupations, living wage careers, and it spans from healthcare to social workers to barbers to cosmetologists to roofers and funeral directors and embalmers. There's over 115 different occupations that have had licensing requirements in place, discretionary and some mandatory, that to many individuals, not even getting to the point of getting to the education and applying, would perceive as, barriers for them to move forward.
Sadiqa, I also wonder, when we're thinking about the whole idea of people with criminal backgrounds, are they aware of these new changes and these new industries that you just mentioned there?
Some are. You know, we are doing our best to spread out the word. We have a community outreach worker, Kevin Woods, who we have going into the community wherever we can send them to spread the message, to inform the public about these opportunities, because there is, you know, I talk to people all the time, and I, you know, whenever I get a chance, like the last thing somebody wants me to come out and say, you know, licensing, because when they hear licensing, they're like, what, you know, what is that? Mm-hmm. But when you start talking in terms that make sense, like, do you want to be a real estate broker? Do you want to be an insurance producer? You know, these are not just careers. For some, it could be, you know, their opportunity to be an entrepreneur. For individuals with convictions, they face barrier after barrier in terms of employment. And a lot of them, if they have the motivation and the ambition to be that self-starter and to have their own business, getting that license or certification is key to moving forward.
So there's two parts of this, right? Yeah, as you've been talking about, there's the people who are returning, but then there's the company side of this. And
right.
Johnny, when we're thinking about SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management, I wonder what kind of things you all are doing in terms of thinking about. I imagine it's a pretty big cultural change for a lot of employers to think about this whole population as a potential workforce population.
Well, the good news is we have, you know, a hot economy. We have, you know, record low unemployment nationally at 3.9%, Illinois as of August at 4.1%. And frankly, we had a very low birth rate for the last almost two decades. So the fact of the matter is, this is a good time for us to make this case, because we're going to employers who say, I either don't have people to fill my open jobs, or I have people, but they don't have the right skill set. So there's a skills gap. And so people, the market, when I speak of that, the employment market, people are more likely, and organizations are more likely to be receptive to the conversation now simply because they need talent. And so we, from the SHRM, the Society of Human Resource Management's perspective, is we're using this very hot market to make the case and to get employers to consider people that they heretofore wouldn't have considered.
And when we're thinking about, we've been talking about changes in Illinois, I wanted to ask you, Johnny, also about the federal level. There have been changes to banking policies that's made it easier to hire people who have been convicted of minor crimes. And I think this also brings up the question of the type of crime. And I wonder how much you think employers think about the magnitude of the crime or how long ago something happened. How key is context to this?
Well, and we have all sorts of research at SHRM that suggests fewer than 1 in 10 HR managers and, frankly, line managers, you know, just a little over 10%. Most, the overwhelming majority of line managers and HR professionals are willing to work with individuals with criminal backgrounds. Now, they want some context. They want to understand, you know, was it a minor offense? Was it a violent offense? How long ago was it? Was this something that someone did when they were 17 and now they're 35? And how long should someone continue to be sentenced forever for something they did two decades ago? Those are the questions and the factors that we're taking into consideration. But I must admit, when we talk to employers, what we hear, and our members are telling us, that there are really three categories. There are three reasons why that we call barriers. Licensing is obviously one on the state side, but there's legal liability. There's the concern. I mean, the Cassandis, and I think I pronounced her name right, you know, it says, you know, she had a history of retail theft. And so, yes, she wants a license to take care of the elderly at home. We have, you know, there's a real perception problem that, okay, so if you take this person who has shown an indication to engage in this behavior, a likelihood to do it, and you put them in home with an elderly person who can't, you know, oftentimes even speak for themselves, and if something's missing in that home, why did you put that person in that situation? So their legal liability.
And Johnny, before you get to the third, if I could pause you thought for just a second, because we do need to take a quick break. Can you hold on for a minute and we'll pick this up just on the other side of this? All right. If you stay tuned, we'll continue this conversation just after this short break. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about some changes in Illinois that might make it easier for people with criminal backgrounds or criminal records to get hired. You know, the National Employment Law Project has estimated that people in Illinois with criminal records or arrest histories, that includes those who aren't charged or convicted, account for 42% of the state's population. That's why we've been talking about this issue with Sadika Williams with the Safer Foundation. She's the Vice President of Policy and External Affairs. Johnny Taylor's also been online with us. He's the president and CEO of the Society for Human Resources Management, SHRM. Johnny, you were, before the break, going through three different things that you thought employers were that give them pause about hiring people with criminal records. And you were talking about liability. Refresh our memory. What were the other ones?
Yeah. So they really fall into three categories, the barriers, and they're largely about perceptions, admittedly, not quality of work. It starts with legal liability. Something happens, and you know, you have someone who's formerly incarcerated, say, for example, for a retail theft crime. They come into your workplace and they steal again, or, you know, create some damage or loss to someone, and then you're held accountable. So employers are concerned about that. Related to that is customers are, you know, concerned about that. Although we know in some states as high as 40% or so, as you said, of the people in that state have either criminal records, arrest records, convictions, et cetera, the fact of the matter is people have their own biases. And I hate to use that word, but there's a bias and a fear. And some of it, you know, comes out of popular television. You know, you watch it, you know, Orange is the New Black, and this is what people do in prison and da-da. So there's a perception problem from a customer reaction standpoint. And then finally, it's regulations. The licensure issue in many states have served as barriers for people and made it very difficult for people to be hired. So all three of those things working together have really created, really, in some cases, insurmountable barriers for people. And what we know at SHRM and all of our research says, it's unwarranted that more than half of HR professionals and managers say that, you know, they have a good experience with individuals who have been formerly incarcerated, again, with context, certain crimes, and the longer the period exists from the time that they were released until the time that they come into workplace, there's a better chance that you're taking on significantly less risk.
Sadika, as Johnny's talking about all of these perceptions and the stigma that we have involved here, I wonder if we could just end with your thoughts on how we go about dismantling those perceptions, removing some of the stigma. What would you say to prospective employers right now or people who are in a position to hire? Sadika? Okay, sorry. It looks like we've lost her. Johnny?
Oh, there we go. Sorry.
Okay, we've got you back. Go ahead, Sadika. Okay, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. I would say to prospective employers that there are successful, and I won't say programs, I will say companies who have made hiring from the local community, and a lot of those individuals will be people with records. They've had amazingly successful results. Johns Hopkins Hospital is one anchor institution that has had a program hiring people with records for over a decade and have had no problematic terminations of those individuals. In fact, they have higher retention rates and their bottom line is improved. And so we say, okay, yes. Well, what are the best practices? Why are they so successful? And it's because of the model hiring policies that they have put into place that will actually ensure that they're compliant with all the new laws, whether it's federal or state, but also that they have an individualized assessment of individuals based on not only their experience and their credentials, but when considering any kind of convictions, it is just a factor in an overall hiring decision. Considering a lot of the items that you heard Johnny mention in terms of the age at the time of the criminal offense, how long ago it happened, what's evidence of rehabilitation. And I just wanted to kind of add a point in terms of kind of what are the barriers. I would say to employers that their hiring policies in themselves could pose a barrier to actually getting people hired in employment. If they have any kind of assessments, pre-hire assessments at the front end that are automatically screening out individuals based on key terms, And also, if they just have a hiring, a conviction matrix where they're saying, okay, for this type of offense, we're not going to hire this individual. We're in the look-back period will be infinite. It won't be 10 years. It won't be 5 years, but whatever.
Just creating whole categories of things, it sounds like, as well, right, Sadika?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we have to look to, on the employer side, in terms of how are their hiring policies, and how are they using any kind of assessments that could be screening out some individuals as well.
Lots of advice there. I want to thank Sadika Williams with the Safer Foundation, Johnny Taylor as well with SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Be well.
Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
With that announcement, President Franklin Roosevelt and the United States formally entered World War II. But the value of hindsight shows us that speech was much more than just a declaration of war on the Japanese abroad. It also, in many ways, ended up becoming a declaration against Japanese American citizens living on U.S. soil. In February of 1942, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which forced more than 100,000 Japanese Americans out of their homes and into U.S. camps. And with the help of the War Relocation Authority, a 250,000 Japanese Americans later then moved to the Midwest. Throughout the 1940s, nearly half of these people moved to Illinois. Rustin Gates has been researching Japanese-American resettlement in central Illinois, specifically in Peoria. He's an associate professor of history at Bradley University, and he's on the line with me from Peoria now, along with Tina Morris, who's a student at Bradley. Rustin, Tina, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
In studio with me and here in Urbana is Megan White, who's in the history department at the U of I. Thanks for being here, too, Megan. I wonder if we could start by you sharing. You study this, but you have family connection to this history. Can you tell us your family's experience?
Yes, and thank you for having me on the show. My family, or at least my mother's side of my family, are Japanese immigrants. My great-grandfather came from Hawaii as a plantation worker, and then he later on came to actually Indiana and Illinois, where he lived for a time before moving to California. And my grandparents, along with my family members, were later incarcerated in Heart Mountain, Wyoming camp, and then they later resettled into the Midwest. So not Illinois, but Ohio, Cleveland. So area as well.
And there were so many people, as it turns out, who ended up resettling in the Midwest. Rustin, what role did the War Relocation Authority play in the popularity of the Midwest and moving people who had been on the coast for generations in some cases?
They had the major role. They really served as sort of a PR organization where they would send out WRA officials to local communities to try and drum up support for welcoming resettlers, meeting with different groups, employers, churches, and actually presenting the case that these were American citizens, that these were a workforce that was not being utilized, and that they could help the community in addition to helping the local economy, and also putting fears to rest that they were spies or enemies or disloyal. And I think, at least in the Peoria case, they did a wonderful job of this sort of PR in this PR campaign.
So, Tina, you looked into this about how many people relocated to Peoria. What was the big draw?
Well, we had about 130 individuals who came to Peoria and several families as well. And as Dr. Gates said, the draw was two things. OSF, which is the Order of St. Francis Hospital here in central Illinois, was very welcoming, had a lot of nursing programs and skills available for people to learn coming from the camps, as well as Bradley University. Bradley had several people who studied watchmaking, one who is an optician. So I think They were welcoming, and the people who were evacuees were grateful to be either using skills that they had before they went to the camps or learning new skills to take them beyond the camps.
And Tina, you used the term concentration camp in an article that inspired us to do this conversation today. I think some people may be surprised to hear that term. They're familiar with the term internment camps. Why did you use that?
Right. And I think that clarification on that and is that the term in general was before World War II to be people who were evacuated to different areas in times of war, as happened with the Japanese. But because of what happened with the Nazi concentration camps in World War II, it's become so closely linked with the atrocities that were visited upon the Jews and other millions of people who were put in, not just Jewish citizens in Europe, but all sorts of minorities, Christians, people around Europe who were rounded up and treated so badly there. So it's hard for us to hear that and not think that that's the exact same situation because it's now linked to that with World War II. But previous to World War II, this was even what the United States called these camps. Was concentration camps, and it is where that came from.
Right, and an important part I should mention, you were also a history teacher at Metamora High School, so thank you for giving us that history lesson as well about the term. I appreciate it. Rustin, so when we're thinking about the context of people coming from this situation, do we know what the reception was like in terms of when thinking particularly about Central Illinois?
We know in general and anecdotally, and from what I've found, what we found in our research, that it was largely positive. There was, of course, some prejudice, some anti-Japanese feelings, but overall, the reception was quite welcoming. And we know this from editorials and newspapers, and then also from writings by the Japanese resettlers themselves who would write back to relatives of camps saying that they had been welcome, that they were happy to be here and urging others to join them. And so it seems on the whole quite positive.
Rustin, are there still evidence of Japanese American history in Peoria today?
There's not as much as there was when they resettled. The majority of the people, the families, either moved back to the West Coast or moved to Chicago, which had the largest resettler population. Several families did remain in the area, and a couple moved after the war to Peoria because of its good reputation and also because of familial relations. And so there is a small population here, but the majority are in the larger cities on the coast and in Chicago.
Megan, regardless of, it's nice to hear about the positive reception that happened in Peoria, but when we look at the whole reason for why people ended up here in the first place, obviously this is a really shameful part of our history, and I just wanted to ask you why you wanted to do, you're doing your dissertation on this today in 2018. Why is that? Why was that important to you?
My dissertation actually ends up looking at the migration of Japanese in the South, but I also have just a very personal connection and a very passionate connection because I'm recalling when I was an undergrad, a professor of mine had said that history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. And I wanted to think about the echoes of today. Certainly there are a lot of parallels and there are a lot of political imperilments, and I think that I want to follow in the footsteps of many different Japanese American activists who are speaking out. But I would want to say that it's interesting when I teach about Japanese internment to my students and later resettlement, when I ask them the question about what happens, do they know anything about resettlement? And a lot of my students don't know. They might know a little bit about the camps, but they don't really know about the resettlement experience and the processes of that. And
so it's a really, I imagine for you, for all of you, a really important part of our history to even be teaching this current generation about this. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I really want to thank Megan, for being with us. Megan White is at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Tina Morris and Rustin Gates with Bradley University. We will have more on this at our website at 21stshow.org. If you'd like more information, particularly about the Peoria angle of it, you can always head to 21stshow.org. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.